must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
Hey there, travelers. My name's Kai, and welcome to an episode of Proudly Radical. As those of you who follow the schedule know, Sundays are for a scripted, pre-recorded, topical dive episode. But this week, given the events of the last couple of weeks and per a suggestion from the community, I thought I would republish my episode on the origins of and problems with policing. It's episode 8, if you want to hear it, it's in its original entirety. But following the events of the murder of George Floyd at the knee of Derek Chauvin, and the inaction taken by his fellow officers and the Minneapolis Police Department, the city has burned, and the populace is in open revolt, with many other cities and even countries now following suit. Now, while I have been openly encouraging people to actively temper their expectations, especially within my community, I also want to mention that this is the opportunity needed that I spoke about at the end of this episode you're about to hear, so keep that in mind as you listen, especially to that last section. In this episode, I cover the basic history of how we ended up with what we identify as the modern institutions of police departments, their development in the United States, their ties to racism and slavery, the reasons we have such poor policing in general, and possibly what it means to everyone, not just the generally oppressed. Now, as of the moment, nothing has truly changed in our society, but for the first time, I have seen a glimmer of what it will take for a revolutionary change in the culture and status of American politics. As many of you that are familiar with my work thus far know, ideologically, I'm an idealist, but personally, I'm a pessimist. So I am still very much waiting to see how the events of the last week shake out in the long run. But if we can get, at the very least, police reformations enacted, then all the other protests that need to happen can finally begin to happen. So for this, I am guardedly excited. This has also awakened something long dormant within the American psyche. The willingness to say, fuck it, and just throw caution to the wind and openly defy the government. It's admittedly refreshing to see that again on this scale. So without further ado, here's Past Kai with the origins of and problems with policing. This episode is essentially about American policing, but looking at it from a historical perspective and maybe getting a little window into why it is what it is. But I'm going to start it with what may be a slightly apocryphal tale, but we do have a large amount of information and historical record that backs up what I'm going to say. And so there are no firsthand accounts of it, but we do know that a lot of the key details line up essentially perfectly. And so this is likely true, but there's no real way to prove it. Basically, our story starts with Sir Robert Peel. Sir Robert Peel was a rising star in the Tory party in Britain, which the Tories are essentially the conservative party. He entered the cabinet in 1822 as Home Secretary, and he actually did introduce what became a number of very important reforms to British criminal law. He essentially reduced the number of crimes that were punishable by death. He simplified the law, making it easier to understand and having less loopholes and less catch-alls. And he repealed tons of criminal statutes and consolidated down the criminal acts into what would become known as the Peel's Acts. And in 1829, Peel established the Metropolitan Police Force of London, which would be the world's first metropolitan police force. It would be the foundation, the groundwork that we all understand and know as modern police forces. At the time, they had just over 1,000 constables employed, and they were affectionately known as Bobbies. Robert Peel. That's where they got their nickname. And that is for certain. We know that. Admittedly, they were fairly unpopular at first, but the venture in the midterm proved successful in lowering the rates of crime in London. And by 1857, all the cities in Britain were obligated. They were obliged to form their own police forces. So in 1829, when setting forth the principles of policing and democracy, Sir Robert declared, and it's a fairly infamous quote from him, that, quote, "the police are the public and the public are the police." It was a method, a means to level out the inequity, the power abuses that were occurring between what used to be law enforcement and the general populace. Now, Sir Robert had a hobby. He had a passion outside of work, outside of Parliament, outside of being a lord. He liked to raise pigs. The Tamworth pig is a fairly infamous breed of pig, and it was named for the town that it was located in the region of Staffordshire, where they were bred and raised by Peel, well, by his servants. He was a lord, after all. He had a manor. He had an estate. He had a farm attached to said estate, and that was his side hobby, was he liked to breed and raise pigs. Now, Smithfield Market is a very infamous market. It's located, at the time, quite near the center of London proper. And due to many, many years of experience, they understood what the trouble that driving, and remember, this is like driving cattle. It's, you drive, you move, you encourage the animal to move forward. Driving animals to the center of London was quite a messy proposition. Essentially, they would shit everywhere. They would just leave a stream of piss and shit and potentially carcasses if any of them died on the way. And so it was a mess. And so it was made illegal quite some time before that for livestock to be driven through the city because of all the havoc, filth, and disease that they would spread everywhere. But as we all know, fresh sells for higher market prices. And so Sir Robert Peel ordered his staff to drive his pigs to the center of London, to Smithfield Market, for sale, for slaughter and sale, or for sale as well. And to ensure that this went down without a hitch, he ordered his constables to flank them. And so they would flank and go ahead and clear the path for Sir Robert's pigs as they walked through London. They'd be knocking over stalls. They'd be eating produce on the way in. And so this is what we think to be the actual origin point for referring to cops as pigs. They used to refer to them as Peeler's pigs. And so the origin point of the term pig is from the very first chief of police, the man who founded the police department as we understand it, went on to abuse his power and abuse his position to ensure that his commercial success of his side venture to ensure that his side venture was commercially successful. And so this is the sort of framework, this is the lens that you have to view all policing from. Modern metropolitan policing, as we know it, was set up by a man who was had the highest aspirations. The police are the public and the public are the police. But in the same token, he was completely willing to abuse his position for financial gain. I mean, what were you going to do? Who are you going to complain to? The guy literally who set up the cops, who's in charge of the cops, is doing this, is knocking over his produce, his pigs are knocking over your produce stall. They're eating it. They're shitting on the street. And his constables are protecting them. Now, the potentially apocryphal part of this is whether the people literally called the constables Peeler's pigs. Now, there are several accounts that say that, in fact, that is true. But we don't know that for certain. Now, all the other stuff, the fact that he did, in fact, drive his pigs through the center of London, the fact that it was illegal at the time, the fact that, yeah, all of that, totally known, totally confirmed by history. So, with that being the lens that we view the police through, let's move over to America for a moment. Now, the development of policing in the United States closely followed the development of policing in England. In the early colonies, policing took essentially two forms. It was both informal and communal. That was referred to as the watch. Now, the other side of that was a private for-profit policing, which colloquially was known as the big stick. The watch system was composed of community volunteers whose primary duty was essentially to warn of impending danger. Boston created their first night watch in 1636, New York in 1658, and Philadelphia in 1700. Their job was essentially to stand out on the street corner at night to look for robbers and muggers and rapists and fires, especially fires. That's what they were there. While the rest of the community slept, they were supposed to just keep an eye out for something happening. And that was the function they served. But it was primarily just volunteers from around the general community. Now, augmenting the watch system was a system of constables and official law enforcement officers of varying types. But they were usually paid by a fee system for warrants that were served. Constables also had a variety of non-law enforcement functions, but it's not really worth getting into many of those. Now, this continued well after the American Revolution. It wasn't until the 1830s that the idea of a centralized municipal police department actually first emerged in the United States. Now, the first one was in Boston. It was in 1838. That was the first established American police force. They were followed by New York City in 1845, Chicago in 1851. There's others and others. It's not worth listing them all. But by the 1880s, all major U.S. cities had some form of municipal police force in place. Now, all of those municipal police forces were derived from the Big Stick. Now, the Big Stick was the private for-profit policing system. Now, essentially what that was the local merchants and businessmen and landed gentry would contribute money to a fund, and they would buy the building, they would buy the land necessary, they would buy the uniforms, the weapons, they would pay the salaries of them. And it was not, let's say, uncommon. In fact, it was everyday practice for merchants or manufacturing facilities or shipping facilities to utilize the Big Stick to union bust. Anytime the workers decided to revolt in any way, shape, or form, the owner of the companies or the owners of the industries would just call in the Big Stick, and they would go in and beat the living shit out of people, kill them if necessary, until the uprising of the peasants or the revolting was squashed. This is literally the origin of essentially the Northern Metropolitan Police Forces. Now, the Southern states followed a different path they had a different path entirely to following the development of the RAIN policing efforts. Essentially, the genesis of the modern police force in the South is the slave patrol. The first formal slave patrol was created in the Carolina colonies in 1704. Now, they had essentially three functions. One, to chase down, apprehend, and return to their owners runaway slaves. Two, they were providing active deterrence for those slaves who might revolt in the form of essentially a localized terror squad. You knew if you had one of these slave patrols in your general area that if you as a group of slaves tried to do anything, they were going to come in and do some horrific things to you guys. And so it was a method of psychological torture and restraint. And three, they were used as a form of summary punishment for slave workers outside of the law if they violated any plantation rules. Essentially, if you had a group of slaves that misbehaved on your plantation, you could pay the local slave patrol to come in and whip them, chop off some hands or feet or whatever. So, you know, they were an ad hoc mechanism for punishment on the plantations themselves. But following the Civil War, these groups were essentially in name only disbanded. What they actually did is they evolved into the modern Southern police departments, essentially as primarily as a means of controlling freed slaves who are now laboring in what was essentially an agricultural caste system. And after that, you fast forward into the 1900s, and what you find is now they're enforcing the Jim Crow segregation laws. So the Northern police departments were there to enforce the will of the moneyed elite. The Southern police forces were there to literally restrain the slaves as they were. Now, we have to touch on, in this instance, talking about the abolishment of slavery, we have to talk about the 13th Amendment. Now, if you're not familiar, the 13th Amendment is the amendment that is generally billed as the amendment that abolished slavery in the United States. But most people don't know the language of the 13th Amendment. And so it's worth reading. It says, quote, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, comma, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, comma, shall exist within the United States, comma, or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime." With those words, slavery and involuntary servitude were literally codified and institutionalized into America's prison system. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Ruffin v. Commonwealth actually held that, quote, he is for this time being a slave of the state, end quote. So when you look at things like GEO and Corrections Corp of America outsourcing to these large corporations using what is essentially involuntary servitude and slave labor, you know, using them for Apple and Microsoft and, I mean, clothing companies and all sorts of things, that is 100% constitutional. Slavery, jail time is turning people into slaves. So we didn't abolish slavery. We essentially just rebranded slavery into the criminal justice system, quote unquote justice. So let's jump forward a bit. Let's jump to the modern problem, the rise of the warrior cop, because we all know our system is racist. We know that that prison is abusing and exploiting the prisoners. But most people, again, that's why I cover that, don't understand that that is historically accurate and constitutionally legal. But the thing that most people discuss in the context of modern policing can be classified as this phenomenon of the warrior cop. Now, we should talk about who gets to be a cop in modern America. The answer? Basically anyone. As long as you're not too smart. Now, that may sound like it's a dig, like it's an insult. That's actually the result of multiple court cases. In fact, multiple courts have upheld the decision to screen police candidates for having too high of an entrance exam score or too high of an IQ. That's for real. Police for ages have been screening people for too high of an IQ or too high of an entrance exam score. They don't want thinkers. They don't want people who are going to second-guess commands. They don't want people who are going to ask questions or too many questions. That's bad for business. So let's just go out on a hypothetical. Let's say you're applying for the police force. And let's say you get past all of the screening and you're in. What now? Well, the police training starts in the academy. Well, we should mention, by the way, I should mention that... there is a psychological test that you have to pass. And most people, you know, when discussing these sorts of insane incidents with police, often go to, you know, a psych exam. What the hell? How do they? Okay. So you can literally go to job testing websites. And for last time I checked, it was about $145. They will teach you how to pass a police psych exam, what you need to answer, and why and how you need to answer it so you can get past that test. So it costs you about $150 usually to get all of the learning materials you need to pass the psych test to become a cop. Yeah, that's comforting, right? So you're in. The training starts in the academy. Now I have to mention, I grew up, I was steeped in this. NRA members, law enforcement. I've got FBI in my family, not immediate, but, you know, military, law enforcement, feds. I've got all of this in my family and extended family and in circles around me. So I have seen the inside of this. I've seen the footage. I've seen the training materials. Now, the concept of officer safety is insanely emphasized these days. Rookies are taught what's known as, well, widely known as the first rule of law enforcement. It essentially boils down to this. An officer's overriding goal every single day is to go home at the end of their shift. That's it. They're not there to protect you. They're not there to put themselves in the line of danger to ensure your safety. They're there to ensure their own safety. They teach this. If you want to look, search for officer training videos. Look for academy training videos. They're all over the internet. They're easy to find, and they're disturbing to watch in their entirety. When you start looking at them as a compendium and look at how they're training police officers, it is exceedingly disturbing. So that's rule number one. The end of your shift, you want to go home. Fuck everything else. Then they start drilling into their heads that they have to always be alert and ready. The quote that often is used in these sorts of training materials is that complacency kills. So they're putting them on edge. They're getting them ready to always be ready, no matter what. Now, I mean, on its surface, that sounds okay. They should be prepared and ready, right? But that's what's leading up to what everybody sees. When they get out of their car and approach you, they've got their hand on their gun, they are ready to shoot you. That's the tip of the iceberg right there. They're prepared to end your life because they want to go home. And if they hesitate, they're going to die. That has been drilled into their head over and over. And it's not just textbooks. It's not just lecturers, because now they show them in high definition, crystal clear, vivid, soul-crushing dash cam footage and body cam footage of officers being punched and kicked and shot after a split second of hesitation. Now, there's not that much footage of it in actuality. They have a very low fatality rate, very low assault rate. You can check my website, kaisthings.com. I have an article about the police, and it breaks down the dangerous professions in this country and the fatality and overall mortality rate of police officers. And it's called Police Officer Fatalities, or How to Control a Populace Using Lies and Force. And it breaks down in that article exactly who has the most dangerous jobs. And the police aren't even on the top list. Like, they're not even in there. So they have pumped them full of fear. They have told them if they hesitate for a moment, they're dead. Then, as they're watching this footage, listening to, and they do show them fatal footage, listening to that officer's final desperate calls for help, I guarantee you, almost all the rookies in attendance are usually having very similar thoughts. I won't let that happen to me. That's not going to be me. Yeah, there it is. That's the crux of the problem with modern policing. They are too afraid. They are afraid of everyone. They are afraid of everything, and they walk into that job every day armed to the teeth, scared out of their minds. And while we're talking about scared out of their, armed to the teeth, let's talk about the 1033 militarization program, because it bears talking about. Now, I don't know off the top of my head, the original, the 1033 program started as another program name, but it is now known as the 1033 program. The 1033 program is essentially a methodology for the militarization of the urban it's a methodology for the militarization of the everyday police department. Police departments are allowed to buy surplus military gear from the federal government at a discounted rate, and they do. They buy things like MRAPs, which looks like a fucking tank. It's not a tank. Technically, it's not a tank, but if you see it on your street, it is the scariest fucking vehicle, and it is bomb-proof. It is everything proof. It is terrifying. They're all walking around with AR-15s. They're all walking around with flak jackets. They're all walking around with this level of military-grade weaponry that they have no business having. So they're armed to the teeth, to the level of actual other countries' militaries. Our cops are literally armed to the point that other countries' militaries are very similar in their armaments. Scared out of their minds. Add to that, they have no consequences. They have qualified immunity. It doesn't matter if they it doesn't matter if they lob a flashbang into a crib of a baby and it fucks up the, it just blows off part of the baby's face. That happened. No responsibility. It doesn't matter if they shoot a dude on the ground who's complying. Doesn't matter. They get away with that. They get away with everything. There's very few instances. Sure, they happen. And when they happen, they get publicized because it's such a rarity. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of the time, when cops commit insane crimes, they get away with it. There are no consequences for most police officers. If they didn't violate multiple civil rights, cause physical harm, do it on camera from multiple angles, and all of that gets released to the public, there's a high probability they're going to get away with it. The latest example is there was a cop. Let me see if I can find it very quickly. There's a cop in Colorado who was found out, who was found passed out drunk in his car, six times the limit, in an unmarked squad car, in the middle of the road, in the middle of the day, and he's facing no charges. There are no consequences for cops. And even when there are, taxpayers foot the bill. Cops don't have to pay any money. It doesn't come out of their pension or their pocket or out of the police union's pocket or out of the department's sort of insurance fund. There is no liability insurance for cops. Oh, it was a $2.5 million settlement as a result of that shooting. So the city pays that, which means the taxpayers pay that. That's it. That's what it looks like. Even when they're held accountable, they're not truly held accountable. And if they're allowed to resign rather than be fired, their certification as a police officer stays intact and they just move to another police station. And you better believe they hire them, because the thin blue line, the fraternity, the brotherhood of the fraternal brotherhood, they back each other up. And if you cross that line, oh, Lord, there's quite a few cases of what happens when a cop, an actually good cop, turns against the bad cops and goes on the record or attempts to testify or attempts to go public. What happens? Death threats. They drive. In one instance, the officer and their family had to move out of the country because of the insane level of death threats they were receiving. It's not just in that locality. If they move, cop just calls another cop in another place, and now a new police department starts fucking with them. It's insane. A DOJ study, which relied solely upon voluntary information submitted by police officers themselves. So the Department of Justice asked police officers voluntarily to submit answers to a few of their questions. And in that study, there was some very revealing information. 84% of the police officers reported that they had seen their colleagues use excessive force on civilians. 61% of them admitted they don't report, quote, even serious criminal violations that involve abuse of authority by fellow officers. So 84% of police officers in this completely voluntary survey said that they've seen colleagues use excessive force, and 61% admit they don't report even serious criminal violations. That's the reality of policing. I mean, I'm reminded of Lord Acton. You may not know who Lord Acton is by name, but I assure you, you've heard the quote. He was a 19th century British historian. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's it. They have too much power. They are poorly trained. They are pumped full of fear, and they are armed to the teeth with little to no accountability. That's how we ended up in the situation we're in. That's it. That's what it boils down to. There was an author, Terry Price. He wrote Understanding Ethical Failures in Leadership. He referred to a concept called exception making. Essentially, people in leadership roles believe that the rules that govern what is right and wrong don't apply to themselves once they're elevated to that leadership position. It's a common phenomenon. It's what underlies the violation of ethical tendencies in people of power. It happens on all levels. It is a human phenomenon. But when you add in all of these other factors that we have to take into account with police officers, you start to have a very deadly, very toxic mix of behavior patterns. Now, I want to wrap this up by saying, why is this important? Now, I mean, there's the obvious. Minorities are being killed and beaten.
our civil liberty. You know, there's the obvious, but why should we do something about it? Why is this the most important thing? And I do believe it is the most important thing to address in our society. Because if we want to change any of the other wrongs, any of the major issues in our society, be it a leaking oil pipeline being run through your land, be it fracking water poisoning the water table around you, be it the exploitation of labor in your region, be it the giant pools, ponds, lakes of fetid pig and cow shit as a result of industrial agricultural processes. If you want to do it, be it lobbying money, Citizens United, if you want to do anything about these sorts of things, at some point, you're going to have to fight the system. At some point, you're going to have to rally. At some point, you're going to have to protest. And guess what? Guess who's the first ones to show up when you do that? The cops. And they're going to kettle you. If you're not familiar with that, that's a term for surrounding protesters and compressing them into a space so they're easier to rein in and arrest and or beat. They're going to kettle you. They're going to beat you. They're going to pepper spray you, which is chemical warfare. If they did that, if our military did that, that's a war crime, but we do it to our own people. It's perfectly legal. They're going to shoot you with rubber bullets. They're going to shoot you with real bullets. They're going to surveil you. They're going to add your face to a nationalized database. So they have a database of all the rabble rousers. It's a very real phenomenon. So if you want to change anything, really, truly, in this country, the things that matter the most, chances are you might have to protest at some point. And the people who are going to prevent that protest from truly being effective are the police. And if you don't think that they won't do that, I don't know how to help you, really. Go online and check how most protests end. They end either they fizzle out or the cops come in and they just shut it down. And that happens globally. But the problem is most places on the globe, the cops aren't armed like the military. And so if the people need to fight the cops, they can effectively fight the cops. But here, the cops will gun you down. That's a very real possibility for any interaction that any person has with the police forces in America. And so it has a chilling effect. I have spoken to many people over the years that is one of the fundamental reasons why they don't organize protests, is because if they do, people are going to get hurt and or die because of cops. That's why we need to deal with them. We need to deal with them for a multitude of reasons. But if we're going to have systemic change in our society, we have to address the police issue, because the police maintain the status quo. And the status quo serves the elites. It serves the moneyed interests in our society. And so there never was an era of serve and protect. It just didn't happen. It's conjured up from 1950s idealized propaganda. In essence, as we've covered, their history lies in oppression and violence. That's how they got their start. That's how they evolved. That's what they still are. Look at NYPD, look at LAPD, look at Chicago PD, look at Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Force. They have histories and a present of unending, unacceptable levels of violence and unchecked levels of violence because they have no consequences. So that's essentially my podcast on the history of the police, on metropolitan police forces, essentially globally, but mainly within Western democracies. I hope you learned something. I hope it was enlightening. I hope you're not too angry. I encourage anybody who's listened to this to go out and learn some more history, learn specific cases, and see how those cases where there's a positive outcome are the exception, not the rule. If you want to truly fuck up a situation, call the cops. Nothing gets better when the cops have been called. Everything gets worse.
Well, thanks, Past Kai. Present Kai back again, guys. I think that that last section is especially prescient, if I may say so myself, given the circumstances we've witnessed as of late. Whether it just be the general response to the protests, even when they were completely peaceful, the police have deployed tear gas, chemical warfare, by the way, hard plastic bullets, aka rubber bullets, which make them sound soft. They aren't. They're very hard. And militarized methods against their own communities. They've blinded multiple people in the style of the Chilean police, including a journalist. And let's point out that they have been targeting journalists for arrest, detainment, and otherwise isolating them. They've blinded so many people at this point. It has become a thing. Just yesterday, there was a young man in Sacramento that took a hard plastic bullet to the face. They're supposed to be aiming at the ground and at the legs. They have beaten, gassed, and kidnapped people that they're supposedly, though as you now hopefully understand a little bit better, are under no legal obligation to protect. They are not the friend of change or progress. They maintain a status quo that is raping and pillaging the people and lands of this world. I truly, from the bottom of my heart, hope that this is the first step. But never forget, what we're doing here is not a sprint. Hell, it's not even a jog. It's an ultra marathon across the face of the planet. It's something that will likely span generations of activists, revolutionaries, and thinkers and doers of all sorts. So pace yourselves, my brothers and sisters. Moderate expectations. Expect setbacks. Don't be afraid to compromise. Just never compromise yourself or your principles. We're all in this together, and through solidarity, we can finally achieve the change we also desperately need and richly deserve. My name's Kai, and this has been Proudly Radical. As always, you can find all of my stuff at kaisthings.com, kaisthings.com, and I hope you're as well as you can be. Till next time, folks.